All right, hello everyone. You are watching or listening to the JW Review, and this is usually the podcast where we go over next week's Watchtower study article, but this time we're going to do something a little bit different. I have on the show today a guest, Dr. Matt DeLockery. So I'm going to have Matt introduce himself and kind of who he is and what he does. But the reason why we're doing this is because I kind of want to just switch up things a bit. Usually we're just talking about Watchtower and Jehovah's Witness type of stuff. But I think this will be really cool because Matt is a New Testament scholar, and he really has some focus on the person and work of Jesus Christ, which is something that we discuss quite a bit on this podcast. So Dr. Matt DeLockery, welcome to the JW Review.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Great. Well, Matt, just to kind of get everything started here, let's just have you talk a little bit about who you are and just your background.
Yeah, so I got taken to church from the time that I was young, and it wasn't something I ever really thought about. It was just sort of when you just go to church because that's what you do. When I was about 13, something occurred to me, and that basically changed my path forever. It occurred to me that if this thing that we call Christianity is actually true, then really there's nothing more important anywhere. I mean, of all things, it is the most important because you're talking about something that's eternal and that, you know, God created everything and has done something with humanity, and, you know, nothing in the world matters nearly as much as that if it's actually true. And so what happened is, at that point, I started pursuing, you know, trying to find out, you know, what is Christianity really, and is it true? Though I don't think I was quite framing it in that sort of a question at the time. I didn't really know enough. I was just sort of following my gut, and I had an interest and a curiosity in trying to understand things. And that took me through college and seminary and beyond. And since that time, I've done two things that really impact, you know, what we're going to be talking about today. I created a ministry called Why Should I Believe? It operates on the campus of Georgia Tech, and we've recently started chapters at Cornell, and we're starting one at Georgia State. And I've also earned a PhD in New Testament, and I've been trying to find answers to what I was looking for when I was younger. You know, what is Christianity? Is it true? And the ministry is all about answering those things like, is there even a God at all? How do we know that? Did Jesus actually rise from the dead? Is there any evidence for that? And my research has been asking the question, you know, what is Christianity? What is the essence of the Christian worldview? If you were to boil everything down and just its very, very basics, what is it really? And so the path that I started on, you know, it's 22 years now, has led me to where I am, and hopefully I found some answers, and now I'm trying to share those with people.
Great. So you recently received your PhD. So tell us a little bit about kind of getting into more detail about what that whole program was like and why you even sought out to get a PhD.
Well, the point of the PhD was really to find answers to questions that I was looking for. I'm not necessarily trying to get a job with it. It's about trying to find answers. And that's why I did my focus on the Christian worldview. The process that I went through that is a little bit different than most people because I didn't do an American PhD. I did a PhD through a Dutch university called Radboud University. And European PhDs have no classes. They're research only. So I lived in the States while I was technically going to school in the Netherlands. And I Skyped with my professor and we emailed back and forth. And it was quite the process. We originally started talking and did a little bit of introductory work. And then, you know, about a month in, he was like, "So, Matt, can you read German?" And I'm like, "No." It's like, yeah. "It's very important you learn to read German." And then I got a 10-minute lecture on how I'd be a second-rate scholar if I couldn't read German. So he's basically, we didn't talk again for 9 months, and I just worked on German and because that was important. And then we got back together, and we started working on stuff again. And then in an effort to improve my research skills as well as to investigate something important to my research. Because I was working on the letter to the Colossians, he had me look at the hymn in Colossians 1. It's 6 verses from chapter 1, verse 15 to verse 20. And I spent 2.5 years studying those 6 verses. And it ended up being 5 chapters in my dissertation just on 6 verses, because there's a lot there. So he just kept having me do it again and again. I'd try to understand those verses and write about them. And, you know, I'd send something to him and he'd be like, yeah, yeah, it's very good. You should try it again. And so I'd go back and I'd work on it for another 3 to 6 months. He's like, yeah, it's much improved. You've improved very, very much. I'm very pleased with your progress. Try it again. Every 3 to 6 months, we do that for 2.5 years. And if you're thinking that I would beat my head against the wall if I ever had to do that, yeah, I was there. I felt like beating my head against the wall. It was rough, but I mean, it improved my research ability tremendously. And also, those 6 verses are essentially the essence of the theology of the Christian worldview. So it was really important that I understood those very, very well.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Colossians 1, because as you may know, a lot of my audience is either Jehovah's Witnesses who are currently in good standing in their congregation, or they're ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. But either way, most of my audience are people who have been awakened, so to speak, so they're maybe on their way out, even if it's years down the road, or they're completely out. And they're kind of getting a fresh start as far as, you know, what should I believe about stuff? And I think who Jesus is and what he has done, there's probably not too many questions that are more important to that. But Colossians 1, I'm not sure if you're aware about how Jehovah's Witnesses view Colossians 1, especially verses 15 through 18. I mean, verse 15, where Christ is described the firstborn of all creation, that's something that you could easily hear a Jehovah's Witness quote right after they knock on your door, especially if you talk about being an evangelical or a Protestant or something like that. So let's talk about that, and talk specifically, first of all, about who Christ is, and then we'll maybe go on to talk about what he has done. So you're welcome to kind of focus in on Colossians 1 and talk about some of the research you've done there, but if you need to kind of go off in a different direction to talk about who Christ is, and just kind of think about this from the perspective of someone who now has a fresh start to really kind of think about things for themselves and really develop their thought process and evaluate which doctrines are true and which ones are false.
Yeah. No, I don't want to go anywhere other than Colossians 1. We can stay in those 6 verses and everything you need to know, all of the basic elements about the person and work of Christ are in those 6 verses. So we don't have to go anywhere else. Let me briefly give a layout of how those verses are put together, and I think that'll help make a little more sense for all this stuff as we go along. Now, what you're seeing in those verses, it's what's known as a hymn. Now, it's not a hymn like we talk about today, a hymn like which is poetry set to music. Probably a better way to think of it is creed, like the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed or something like that, one of those early Christian creeds that's basically a whole bunch of theology packed into a little tiny space. And every single word and every single phrase and even the way they're put together has meaning. Now, what you'll notice if you spend some time looking at it is it's really divided up. There's 2 main sections. At the beginning of verse 15, it says, "Who is the image of the invisible God?" That "who is," the relative clause points back to Christ that you see up in verse 13. And then in verse 18b, it says, "Who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead?" So those 2 "who is" statements sort of delineate the 2 main strophes or the 2 main verses. You can call it a verse, like a verse of a song. Strophe is a technical term, and I'm going to continue using that just to avoid the confusion with the word verse. But you have these 2 main strophes here that talk about Christ and his work in original creation, and you have this other one here that talk about Christ and his work in the reconciliation of creation. So how everything was done originally and what he did to put everything back. And then you have this like little middle transitional strophe in the middle that's not this one and it's not that one. And basically what it does is this first strophe, verses 15 to 16, says, this is what Christ did in the beginning. 18b through 20 says, this is what he's done to bring everything to its conclusion and fix what was wrong with creation. And then you've got this little bit in the middle about the church. And that's talking about what Christ has done or is doing in creation now to move from here to here. So these three parts, the two main ones and the little one in the middle, are really telling a story. This is what Christ did in the beginning. This is where things are, where things are going and what he's done to get us there. And this is how the church is being used by Christ to get from here to here. So that's sort of the basic basic layout of what the hymn looks like. Is it okay if I start talking about the first part about the image of the invisible God and firstborn of all creation, or do you want to ask questions about that?
Yeah, go ahead and jump in. I think that lays a good foundation for the kind of the structure of the passage, and I think that's like really helpful because kind of learning exegesis is something that Jehovah's Witnesses don't really know how to do. They're not trained to do that. They're mainly dealing with proof texting, and that's kind of how they do things. So looking at the context in that kind of way, I think that lays a really great foundation. So I'd say, yeah, let's go ahead and jump into verse 15 and talk about some of the particulars about kind of who Christ is.
Okay. Well, in 15 and then, well, in verse 15, and then you have material following in 16, you have two main propositions or two main statements made about Christ. First, he is the image of the invisible God. And second, he is the firstborn of all creation. Now, image of the invisible God isn't that difficult to understand. I think most people, you know, get it pretty readily. It's a lot of theological language, but it's pretty straightforward. Image, we all know what images are. You have an image, you know, like on your phone, you take a picture of something and you have an image there. It's not the actual thing itself. It's a digital representation of something that exists in reality. And they had images in the Old Testament world. They were carved into statues, or they were on coins and things. And so they knew what images were. And an image is exactly what you think it is. It's a representation of something else. And the invisible God, it's straightforward. God's up there. We can't see God. And, you know, you might talk to God or pray to God, but usually you don't get an audible answer. So how do we interact with this God who's up there and we don't really, you know, don't really have a lot of interaction with him in the same sort of way that we would with a person, you know, that we meet or whatever. Well, it's saying that Christ is the way that you get to know the invisible God. He is the representation, and because he's a person, the representative of the invisible God. So that's pretty straightforward. The uncreated creator is something, or I think that's what the firstborn language talks about. The firstborn of all creation basically refers to his role in creation. And verse 16 gives a lot of explanation about what that means, that he created all things in existence. And the thing is that there are three different ways you can look into what this phrase means. What the word firstborn means, the relationship of creation to the word firstborn, as well as the impact of verse 16 on that phrase, firstborn of all creation. And the thing is that all three of these point to Christ himself being uncreated. Now, a lot of people get tripped up on this because the word firstborn sounds like, well, firstborn, born is, you know, a physical thing, and so that means a literal birth, and therefore Christ was part of creation. But the thing is that firstborn really doesn't primarily mean that. There's verses in the Old Testament. I'm blanking on the exact one right now. I think it's Psalm 68. I'd have to go back and check the exact reference right now.
Is it where David is described the firstborn of the kings of the earth?
That's the one.
Yeah, so Psalm 89:27, I believe.
Okay, then you remember better than me. Thank you very much. You've got that where he's talked about as the firstborn, and then it's further described with of the kings of all the earth, and so it's saying that he is the head over the kings. And so also when you look at firstborn in the New Testament, it's primarily used in a meaning that somebody is first in something. It talks about a person's primacy or their firstness rather than their literal birth. And the only place that really talks about literal birth that we know that is certain is Luke 2:7, where it talks about Christ being physically born. And there's, you know, in the creation, in his birth narrative. And there's other things in the text that indicate that that's what's going on. But then you get into verse 16 as well. And what you see there is that Christ is responsible for everything in creation. And the logic is pretty simple here. If all things were created by Christ, then it's not possible that he himself was also created. Because basically that means he'd have to have bootstrapped himself into existence. He would have to have created himself, which doesn't really work. So really everything between the meaning of the phrase, the word firstborn, and everything in verse 16 points to Christ being on the creator side of the creator-creation divide. And he is both responsible for everything in creation as well as himself being uncreated. So it might be better to understand firstborn of all creation as uncreated creator. That's not the wording that's used, but it translates the meaning, I think, better into modern English, because a lot of us just get tripped up with that firstborn language.
Can I offer just a little bit of objection, because I'm kind of thinking about what some of my audience would be thinking, because
sure.
The way Jehovah's Witnesses have traditionally viewed the firstborn of all creation is that some of them might even be comfortable with firstborn meaning kind of preeminence or authority or something along those lines. So you can kind of maybe grant that point. But now when it comes to all creation, what they would say is that it says of all creation, meaning Jesus is actually a member of the creation. So even if he is preeminent or ruler over the creation, that phrase implies that he is actually a member or part of that creation. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the word of isn't actually in the Greek. It's just firstborn, and then there's creation. And so what you have to do is try to figure out what that of means. It could be firstborn of, meaning that he was a part of creation, or it could be firstborn, and you could translate that as firstborn over all creation, in which he was first over it. So there's two different options as far as what that could mean. And verse 16 is really there to help explain which of those two makes better sense. So when you get into verse 16, then it talks about all things were created by him, through him, and for him. And part of the way that helps to understand this is to understand the background language that's being used. The imagery that was used here, or the theology that's being based on here, is that of the wisdom of God. The wisdom of God was an Old Testament and intertestamental way of sort of dealing with this divine transcendence immanence question. You know, sort of the God is up there, okay? Yeah, everybody gets that. But how does a God who's up there interact with us, like, down here? How does that gap get bridged? And one of the ways that they were dealing with this in Jewish theologians were dealing with in the Old Testament is that they were saying that, well, God interacts with his creation, for example, through his wisdom. He created everything in his wisdom. And wisdom is usually used by scholars with a capital W, because it's more than just, you know, God being wise. It's sort of this semi-personification. If you look in Proverbs 8, you can see wisdom personified as a woman calling to men, and it's sort of almost this other character. And there's other terms like this. I don't want to get out of Colossians, but logos, like the reason of God, you find in John 1, another important text to this conversation, is a similar sort of thing. It's a way that Jewish theologians tried to bridge the gap between the God who's up there and man who's down here. And then what the early Christians did is that they took this wisdom idea, this wisdom theology, and they sort of ramped it up and said, okay, well, you know this idea about wisdom. Well, Christ is like that, but more so. And you can see this in the last phrase of verse 16, that all creation was made for him. Now, nothing was said about the wisdom in the Old Testament or anywhere else like that, even outside the Bible, for that matter, that was like that. I mean, wisdom was involved in creation. It helped make creation. But in Colossians, you have wisdom being the goal or the purpose of creation. Everything was made for this wisdom. And what the New Testament authors are doing is identifying that wisdom as Christ and saying that Christ actually is the wisdom of God, but it's beyond what you used to think about wisdom.
Yeah, interesting. I think that's bringing up the for him. I think that's pretty interesting. What implications would you draw from this if it was the case that Jesus did come into existence at a particular point in time, if he was a created person? What would that actually do to this text in Colossians 1:15 through 18? What would that make the text look like?
Well, if he was a created person, then one of the problems does that mean that he could not then be the creator? Are the people who are saying that he's a created person, are they also saying that he was the creator of all things?
Yeah, so if you were reading the New World Translation, which is the Jehovah's Witness Bible, when you go to verse 16, mm-hmm. it would say, "For by him all other things were created, both in the heavens and on earth." So in verse 17, he is before all other things, and in him all things hold together. So they insert that word other there because they believe it clarifies the meaning of firstborn of all creation, which kind of gets them out of that trap of the kind of the phrase you use is Jesus pulling himself by his bootstraps to kind of create himself along with everything else. They put that word other there to kind of get them out of that that trap. So Jesus is the exception, but he created everything else.
That's interesting. I mean, that just doesn't work for two reasons. One, there is no word for other in the Greek. It's just not there. So, I mean, regardless of what an English translation says, the Greek text is the basis for all English translations because that's what was actually written down by Paul, or I would argue Timothy under the supervision of Paul. But that was what was actually written down originally. So that needs to be the basis for any translation that we make. And if it's not in the Greek, then it shouldn't be in the English. But besides that, even if you don't want to go with that or you can't get into the Greek argument, the verse 16 really makes it clear that that's not the case because, I mean, the author of the hymn goes to great lengths to explain that everything in creation was made through Christ. That's why he goes in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones, dominions, rulers, authorities, or that's why he goes through this whole listing of things to make it very, very clear that everything was made through Christ. First of all, he says everything was made through Christ twice, both at the beginning of the verse and then at the end of the verse, that everything was made in him. And then at the end, through him and for him. And second, when you look at something like heavens and earth, everything was made in the heavens and earth. That's a very Jewish way of saying all creation. Think of God making the heavens and the earth in Genesis 1. That's the way that they would say all creation, and nothing was left out. Visible and invisible, it's very clear to say that in that sense, you have everything in creation without exception, because you've got visible and then you have its negation, invisible. So A and not A. So there's nothing that can be outside of an A or not A statement. It's like saying everything that is in the world that is either white or not white. Well, there's nothing that's either white or not white or blue or not blue. It's because that's everything. Because it's a thing and its negation. So when you talk about everything that is visible and invisible, there's nothing left out. And so you're really going against what the author is really, really trying to make clear. He said firstborn of all creation, which firstborn language can sometimes be confused, but it's pointing in that direction. But even if you get that confused, he said twice Christ created all things. And then he goes on this long list of heaven and earth, visible and invisible, thrones, dominions, and so forth. So you can translate it that way, except that you're inserting a word that's not there in Greek, and you're going against the obvious redundancy of the author, who's trying to make it very, very clear that Christ did create all things, thereby making himself uncreated, because he can't bootstrap himself into existence.
So let's say we kind of grant all that, that Jesus is, and let's just use the word, the uncreated agent that God has used to create everything, right?
Okay.
So if that's the case, how would Paul, who was a monotheistic Jew, how would he have worked that out? Because you have God, and then you have the agent, even if you grant that he's somehow uncreated. How do you work that out, or how would Paul have worked that out in the first century using whatever conceptual or intellectual resources they may have had at the time? How would they have worked that out? Because I'm sure the Jewish non-Christian audience would have thought that was just crazy, and that went against monotheism. So how would Paul have worked that out?
Right. They absolutely would have. And Christians at various points in time, and Jesus himself got accused of blasphemy because, you know, trying to, you know, Jesus was basically standing in God's place and acting on his behalf in a lot of the things that he did, such as the parable of the vineyard workers. He's, you know, casting judgment and saying that he was, you know, God's son. And he's, by standing and acting in God's place, they knew exactly what he was claiming. What you see here, if you combine the two statements made about Christ in verse 15, you really have what is early Trinitarian thought. Now, it's not what you see later on in Nicene period and thereafter. Really, what I think was happened is they started by describing Christ and his relationship to God in sort of pictorial terms, sort of in an Old Testament Hebrew kind of way. You know, like you might describe God as a rock. And when you describe God as a rock, it means that God is strong, he's powerful, he's able to accomplish his will, and so forth. It's a very Hebrew way of thinking. You're thinking in images in your mind. A more Greek way of thinking about it would be, instead of describing God as a rock, you might say God is causally active in such a way that he is able to bring about his will in any given point in the universe, such that no other being has the ability to overpower it. You know, some long thing like that. It's a very Greek way of thinking. Now, most explanations of the Trinity or the Incarnation are using Greek language that comes, you know, later on in church history. It's very propositional. You get that persons and natures language. It's really, really difficult to understand because it's not something that comes naturally to most of us. So what I think happened is you start with this very, very early, you know, pictorial, very Hebrew sort of way of thinking of things. And then you progressed later on to the more propositional language when people started to have questions about this sort of thing, like, well, how could this actually work out? And then they had to develop the language later on to explain what was meant. But you see the Trinitarian thought just in these first two things, because uncreated creator, if that's if that is what that means, if you have uncreated creator here, I don't know how you could say that's anything other than God. And yet you have image of the invisible God, which shows that he's distinct from God. So he's both God and distinct from God. And that's basically the sort of idea that you get in the Trinity. You just need to add the Holy Spirit in, so it's three instead of two. But God and distinct from God is really the basics of the Trinity. But, you know, all that later stuff about persons and nature is a way of explaining how that could work without him just being three gods or just one God in different forms. Now, whether Paul or any of the other early Christians actually understood it from a, you know, persons and natures sort of way, I don't know that we can really know that until such point as we step into the next life and, you know, maybe get some answers. I don't know whether we will or not, but if we get some answers, maybe we'll know then. But just from the text, I don't know that we can know whether Paul or anyone else could have explained it in that way. But what we can see is that they had this idea of, you know, Christ as both God and distinct from God all the way back at the very beginning.
Yeah, interesting points there. Just as kind of we need to kind of wrap up here in a minute, but
sure.
Are there any other main points or issues or topics, maybe just kind of spending another 5 minutes with this whole passage in Colossians 1 that you kind of want to dig into, or maybe some things in your PhD research that you learned and you're kind of enlightened by?
Yeah, so I have 7 points about Christ and just to come out of the hymn. That's 2. So there's 5 more. Briefly, he's also referred to as the temple of God. You see that in verse 19. That's not what he's called, but that's what it's implied when it said the fullness of God is dwelling in him. Sort of like, you know, God is present in all creation, but in the Old Testament, like with Solomon's temple, God dwelled in him in a special way. And basically you get incarnational ideas out of that. In verse 18, he's called the firstborn from the dead. You've got his resurrection, which is what he did to sort of fix everything that went wrong with original creation. The word beginning there, basically what that means is that he's the beginner of a new humanity. He started a new group, the new group being the church, which is where everything that he's doing to fix what is wrong with creation and renew us into the image of our creator is being done first in the church. And then the 6th thing I was going to say is the head of the body of the church. So the church is the group that first experiences this renewal, and then they're the ones who go out and share it with everybody else. And finally, he's the reconciler of all creation. You see reconciliation in verse 20. And basically what that means is that everything got messed up at the beginning and he's putting it back. You see language prior to the hymn in verse 13 about that we were transferred from the domain of darkness and into the kingdom of God's beloved Son. The short of it is that what happened, everything was created, in original creation was made in one. Everything was in the kingdom of Christ. With the fall, things split. And there were 2 kingdoms, the domain of darkness and the kingdom of God's beloved Son, also known as the church. And the reconciliation of creation is basically the ending of this domain of darkness, and everything gets put back in line so that everything is pointed in the direction that it needs to go. In other words, God first, man second. And the primary thing that's wrong with us is that we flip the order. And we put man first and God second. We put ourselves above God. And Christ reconciling creation is flipping that and putting it back to where it was supposed to be with God first and man second.
Yeah, great points. Probably need to wrap up here.
Sure.
And so I just want to say to the audience, a lot of you are probably screaming because you may have like a million objections you would want to raise right now. But as you know, we could spend all day talking about this passage. I'm sure, Matt, you could talk all day because you've written a PhD thesis on this passage. There's much, much more you could get into. So for now, Matt, let me just have you kind of take it away here and just leave us with any parting thoughts you may want to leave with the audience as it relates to Colossians chapter 1. Like if the audience could leave away with one thing, what exactly would it be?
Well, I think the thing to do is to understand how all of the pieces of the Christian worldview fit together. And there's really 4 different parts to the Christian worldview. First is that it's actually true. The truth of the Christian worldview is the first thing, because if it's not true, then none of this makes any difference. It's just, you know, it's a nice thing that you believe, and it may or may not help you in life. But, you know, honestly, it's not about having a better life, because remember, Paul was writing Colossians from prison. So, you know, that didn't always work out so well for him. But if it's actually true, then it matters. And the second thing is the personal work of Christ. Who he is and what he has done is the sort of the turning point from how everything was before that, it it fell apart and then it's going to be fixed later. The person and work of Christ point towards the turning point. over here at the very end, you've got how you're supposed to live as a result of that. And in between those two things, you have something that's I call beliefs and actions, that what is actually true affects what you do in your life. So those are the four parts of the Christian worldview: the truth of Christianity, the personal work of Christ, beliefs and actions, and the Christian life. And understanding how all of this fits in the bigger picture will be really, really helpful. So you're not just learning these things and, you know, you have no system to put them in, no way to categorize them or order them. They're just sort of floating out in existence. So understanding how to put all those things together is very important, and understanding where the personal work of Christ fit into that overall, into the whole worldview, will be very, very helpful for making sense of everything.
Well, great. So just as a last thing, Matt, how can we find out more about you? How can we contact you? I know you have a podcast, a website. So tell us a little bit more about that, so that when everyone starts screaming to me with objections, where could I forward them to?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to my website, mattdelockery.com, and I assume you'll put a link to it, or my name will be somewhere so you can spell my last name.
Yes.
Then you can get to links to my social media accounts, and you can yell at me, or if you really want to, or if you want to just ask a question, I'll be happy to answer. No yelling required, but if you want to, you know, no big deal. And also, I do, as Mike said, I do a podcast, and what I'll do is I'll come out with a series of something. I'll talk about some topic in huge depth for, you know, 4 to 6 or 7 weeks. And then I'll be off for a few months, then I'll come back. And, you know, as I put these together, you know, there'll be several, I have several series on, you know, does God exist? I did one a little while back about where the New Testament came from. Started with a Jewish man walking around in Palestine 2,000 years ago, and take it through every single step, through oral tradition, through the canonization process, manuscript tradition, translation, all the way to an English Bible you might hold in your hands today. And really taking it step by step through all of that. So there's a lot of things that that will give you sort of basics of your faith. And I've also going through Colossians in a lot of depth. So if you want to follow that along, or just focus on the points related to the hymn or other parts in it, then there will be some resources there for you for that.
Well, great. I will definitely send all the links in the show notes, so you'll know exactly how to get a hold of Matt, find his website, write him emails, because I will tell you right now, my audience, if you send me 14 paragraphs talking about the generative construction of firstborn of all creation, I may not have the time to respond to all of your points. Matt may not either, but you're welcome to ask him. He has much more expertise in this area than I do. So I hope you all learned something today. I certainly did, and I just appreciate everyone checking this out and just doing something a little bit different this time, and let me know if you'd like to see more of this. So Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, great. For more information about Jehovah's Witnesses and other topics, please visit michaeljfelker.com. There you can also reach me directly to submit questions or comments to be covered on the JW Review. To subscribe to this podcast, please go to iTunes and search for the JW Review.